Real quick, we have to take a break to acknowledge the sponsor of today's episode, which is Secret Nature. Secret Nature's ultra premium CBD gummies are crafted with real botanicals, nothing extra, and designed to fit right into your day with clean, purposeful functionality. So for me personally, I like to take one of their snoozer gummies in the evening to unwind and ensure that I get a good night's sleep. After a long day, especially when my brain is just still running a mile a minute and I can't seem to settle down, I'll take one to help me slow down, unplug, and actually get a good night's sleep. I personally don't drink alcohol because I just don't like the way it makes me feel the next day, but these gummies feel very clean, intentional, and it never leaves me groggy the next morning, just feeling balanced and rested. Secret Nature's gummies are organic and farm grown. They're never lab made. They're ultra premium CBD gummies made with real botanicals and nothing extra. You've got two purpose built options. There's Bliss for clear focus and productive flow if you want to take one during the day, and then you get Snoozers to help you relax and rest at the end of the day. Each gummy has consistent, measured CBD, so there's never any guessing, just clean, reliable functionality that fits naturally into your schedule. Get 30% off your first order at secretnature.com with the code MAMA. That's M-A-M-A. And just a heads up, their Black Friday sale is coming up, and they are going to be offering 25% off on orders of $75 or more, 35% off on orders of $125 or more, and then 40% off on orders of $150 or more between November 26th and the 30th. So don't forget to use my code MAMA when you check out. That's M-A-M-A at secretnature.com.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Fiscally responsible, financial geniuses, monetary magicians. These are things that people say about drivers who switch their car insurance to Progressive and save hundreds. Visit progressive.com to see what you can save. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Potential savings will vary. Not available in all states or situations.
This MLB season, FanDuel's Dinger Tuesday is back. And this year, all customers get a profit boost to bet home runs every week. So gear up to go yard all season long on FanDuel, America's number one sportsbook.
21 plus and present in select states. Opt-in required. Bonus issued is non-withdrawable profit boost tokens. Restrictions apply, including any token expiration and max wager amount. See full terms at FanDuel.com/sportsbook. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
Welcome back to Mama Mystery. I am your host, Kelly, and this is our new segment called The Weekly Docket, where I recap all of the headlines in true crime this week. And I am implementing something kind of new that I'm trying out, which is a video option. So if you want to actually watch me record this or watch the stories and see the pictures associated with the stories, you can go to YouTube, and hopefully I can get this on Spotify as well. Of course, our Patreon will have the video. So let me know what you guys think, and hopefully this works out. I'm a little, you know, I used to think I was so tech savvy, and lately I've just been really doubting that about myself. And so we're going to see how this goes. Hopefully it goes well, but without further ado, we've got so much to talk about. I feel like this is the craziest weekly docket I will have ever recorded, and I've only recorded a handful, but this week was just bonkers in true crime. So let's go ahead and dive in. The first story is coming out of Boston, Massachusetts. In a disturbing case out of Boston, a former Harvard Medical School morgue manager has admitted to stealing and selling human body parts from donated cadavers. Cedric Lodge, who was 57 years old, pleaded guilty in federal court this week to interstate transport of stolen human remains, acknowledging his role in a morbid trafficking scheme that ran for years right under Harvard's nose. Cedric Lodge managed the morgue for Harvard's anatomical gift program for over two decades. According to prosecutors, from 2018 until at least early 2020, he regularly took organs and other parts from bodies that generous families had donated for science, and the inventory of stolen remains is almost beyond belief. We're talking about brains, hearts, skin, hands, faces, even entire dissected heads. Essentially, anything that he could covertly remove after medical students and researchers were finished, but before the remains were supposed to be cremated. So Cedric then smuggled these body parts out of Harvard's morgue in Boston and drove them to his house in New Hampshire. Once he had the body parts in his possession, he and his wife, Denise, would arrange sales to a network of buyers across multiple states. They shipped body parts via mail or met buyers in person to hand off the remains, and the transactions earned them tens of thousands of dollars, according to the court filings. In some instances, he even allowed eager buyers into the morgue itself so that they could pick which body parts they wanted to purchase, like a gruesome shopping trip among donated cadavers. All of this was done without Harvard's knowledge or any permission from the school or the deceased donors' families. And Harvard only discovered the scheme after federal investigators began making arrests. The scandal first came to light with the arrest of a Pennsylvania man named Jeremy Pauley in 2022 for trafficking human remains. Investigators traced Pauley's supply back to Cedric Lodge and then other people as well. Ultimately, a whole ring of 8 people was implicated in buying or selling stolen body parts from Harvard and an unrelated Arkansas mortuary. Several co-conspirators have already pleaded guilty. Lodge's wife Denise, plus buyers Joshua Taylor, Andrew Insania, Matthew Lampe, Angelo Pereira, and Candace Chapman Scott, who stole remains from an Arkansas crematorium and sold them to the ring. In fact, that last one, Candace Chapman Scott, received a 15-year sentence for her role. Lampe and Pereira, who were less central players, have been sentenced to 15 and 18 months, respectively. Others, including Denise Lodge and Joshua Taylor, are still awaiting their sentencing. Until now, Cedric had maintained his innocence and even tried to get the case dismissed on a technical argument that human remains are not goods under the law. But how are you selling them then? How are you collecting money for these remains if they're not goods? But the argument failed, and facing trial and overwhelming evidence, he actually changed his plea to guilty on May 21st. He specifically admitted to transporting stolen human remains across state lines, which makes it a federal offense, now carrying up to 10 years in prison and hefty fines. In exchange for the plea, prosecutors dropped a conspiracy charge and indicated that they'd recommend less than the maximum sentence. His sentencing date has not yet been set. As details of the case emerged, public reaction was one of shock, disgust, and heartbreak. Families who had entrusted their loved ones to Harvard's morgue felt profoundly violated. In fact, about a dozen families filed lawsuits against Harvard last year, accusing the university of failing to protect the donated bodies. Those suits were ultimately dismissed by a judge who ruled that Harvard itself hadn't knowingly done anything wrong, calling Cedric Lodge's actions horrifying, but essentially a rogue employee's conduct. Harvard medical school officials themselves condemned Cedric's behavior as an abhorrent betrayal and morally reprehensible when he was first indicted. The school fired him in 2023 as soon as the scandal came out, stressing that he acted alone without any knowledge or approval from other people at Harvard. In a case this grotesque, even veteran investigators were stunned. Prosecutors revealed that Lodge stole and sold heads, brains, bones, you name it. At one point, he allegedly allowed a buyer to pull a stolen human skin out of a bag to examine it during a meeting. It sounds like lurid fiction, but it is so painfully real. For now, Cedric Lodge sits awaiting sentencing, likely facing several years in federal prison. Harvard has implemented new security protocols at its morgue in the wake of the scandal, and donors' families continue to watch the legal outcomes closely, hoping for some measure of justice or closure. Now on to the next story. In a case that is as horrifying as it is bizarre, an Alabama man took a page out of Wade Wilson's book, apparently, as he is accused of stealing a woman's car, running her over with it twice, and then trying to dispose of her body. The suspect, Logan Michael Rogers, who's 28 years old, has been charged with murder after the remains of 38-year-old Autumn Strickland were found burned in a barrel at his home. Autumn Strickland, who is a mother of one, was last seen during a night out in downtown Florence in mid-May. She had checked into the Strickland Hotel on Friday, May 16th, and visited the hotel's bar that evening. After midnight in the early hours of Saturday, she left the bar around 1:50 a.m. and was captured on security camera running down Court Street at about 2:08 a.m. That's when, according to police, Strickland's own car, a 2012 Kia Soul, came barreling down on her. Shockingly, the driver hit her once, then circled back and struck her a second time deliberately. Authorities believe that Logan Rogers was behind the wheel of Strickland's Kia, using her vehicle as a weapon. Video evidence supports that Logan Rogers struck the victim twice and that this act was intentional due to the location and manner in which it was carried out. In other words, this was no accident. The driver appeared to double back to make sure that the victim was seriously injured. And District Attorney Chris Connolly said that the evidence clearly indicates Rogers' intent to kill Autumn with that vehicle. After the double impact, Strickland was left laying critically injured in a parking lot. Police say she remained on the ground for approximately 30 minutes before the assailant then returned. Rogers had allegedly abandoned the Kia Soul not far from the scene and then somehow got a ride to retrieve his own pickup truck. And then after about half an hour, surveillance footage reportedly shows a truck pulling up, someone loading Autumn's limp body into the vehicle, and investigators believe that it was Rogers who came back for her. What came next is even more disturbing because he allegedly drove Autumn's body to his house in Florence and attempted to dispose of her remains in a burn barrel in his backyard. 3 days later, on May 20th, police executing a search warrant at Rogers' residence made the grim discovery. Human remains in a burn barrel believed to be Autumn's. The remains were badly charred, but investigators sent them to a lab and are confident that the identification will match Autumn. Rogers was taken into custody on May 21st. Initially, authorities charged him with attempted murder, since at first they thought they just had a missing person and then evidence of an assault. But once the burned remains were found, those charges were upgraded to murder. He is now being held without bail in the Lauderdale County Detention Center. And perhaps the most baffling is that by all accounts, Rogers and Autumn were complete strangers. Authorities do not believe that either of them knew each other prior to this incident. It appears to just be a random, opportunistic crime, the worst kind of nightmare scenario. Police are investigating whether they may have crossed paths earlier that night by chance, but so far there's no known connection. As this story came out, Florence residents were horrified. Autumn Strickland was known as a loving mother and friend, and the idea that a stranger might have targeted her at random is just so deeply unsettling. Even law enforcement seemed rattled by the case, saying, quote, "This is one of the most disturbing cases we've investigated in recent memory." Investigators credited surveillance technology and community tips for cracking the case relatively quickly. They also publicly thanked the community for the outpouring of support during the search for Autumn. Logan Rogers has yet to enter a plea. A preliminary court hearing is set for mid-July. In the meantime, he remains in jail, and if convicted of murder, he could face life in prison. All right, this next story is out of Florida. It's a wild Florida man story that sounds almost too crazy to be true, but it unfolded over Memorial Day weekend when a man jumped into a lake full of alligators, got bit by an alligator, then emerged and attacked local deputies, forcing them to shoot him dead. Even the sheriff described this chain of events as just crazy stuff. And here's what happened. It was Monday morning, May 26th, when Polk County Sheriff's deputies got a call about a shaking man acting strangely in a residential neighborhood. The caller said the man seemed disoriented and was asking to call his son. By the time deputies arrived, the man had disappeared into the area around Christina Lake, which is a body of water known to have gators. About 2 hours later, a second frantic call came in. A man was seen swimming in the lake in an area clearly marked for alligators. Neighbors actually tried to intervene, warning him to get out, but the man refused their help and even growled at a neighbor like an animal. At some point, an alligator did attack, and the man was bitten by a gator while he was in the water. But incredibly, he survived that encounter and made it back to land. But when sheriff's deputies finally located the man on land, he was not surrendering peacefully. In fact, things escalated quickly and dangerously. According to Sheriff Grady Judd, the man lunged at an officer with a pair of garden shears, attempting to either stab or slash the officer. Deputies tried to defuse the situation without lethal force, And the sheriff said they actually tased the guy twice, ordering him to drop the shears. But it was as if the taser had no effect. The suspect was unfazed and continued to struggle aggressively. The man then grabbed a brick and smashed the window of a Polk County sheriff's truck, breaking into the vehicle. Inside that truck were firearms, the department-issued rifle and shotgun, so now the stakes were even higher. If the suspect armed himself, it could have turned into a serious, deadly shootout. But deputies shouted for him to stop, and of course he ignored them. So as Sheriff Judd later recounted, quote, he climbed into a vehicle committing another armed burglary where he was trying to get our rifle and our shotgun, and we shot him. Several officers opened fire, and the man, who by then had been through an alligator bite, two taser hits, and relentless commands, was shot and killed at the scene. In press briefings, Sheriff Judd did not miss words about the incident, saying, quote, his conduct was outrageous. It was bizarre, emphasizing that his deputies had no choice but to use lethal force once the suspect attempted to arm himself with law enforcement weapons. The man was later identified as 31-year-old Timothy Schultz, and it turns out that Tim had quite a troubled history himself. Sheriff Judd noted that he was a convicted felon with a long criminal record, including methamphetamine-related charges, and he had been released from the county jail literally just days before this incident. Now, whether drugs played a role in this erratic, almost superhuman behavior that morning is under investigation. Toxicology reports are still pending, but Judd implied that Schultz's behavior with the shaking and irrational decisions like swimming with gators and then just shrugging off two tasers might suggest he was under the influence of something pretty powerful. The deputies involved in the shooting were placed on standard administrative leave while the incident is being reviewed. No officers were injured during the mayhem, aside from some surely jangled nerves. But meanwhile, Polk County locals are equal parts horrified and fascinated by the story. It made headlines across Florida and beyond, with many noting it's the kind of truth that is just stranger than fiction. On social media, people were already dubbing it the ultimate Florida man story of 2025. Florida man fights gator, then fights cops, and loses to both. Memes circulated featuring an alligator with the caption, "I started it," and Florida deputies with, "We finished it." Beyond the dark humor, though, many also praised the deputies for their restraint in attempting tasers and de-escalation first. Others questioned what could have possibly driven Schultz to such extremes. One thing everyone agrees on, though, is that the situation was extremely dangerous and could have been even worse. Had Schultz succeeded in grabbing the rifle or shotgun from the patrol truck, officers' lives and innocent bystanders would have been at grave risk. Sheriff Judd, known for his colorful press conferences, summed it up saying, quote, we tried everything. We tried to talk to him, tase him. Nothing worked. He was determined to get himself or someone else hurt. It was a bad outcome, but it could have been a lot worse. And he was gator bitten along the way. Now, this is just crazy stuff, end quote. And it certainly is. In the end, this unfortunate man's bizarre rampage ended with his death. The alligator that bit him, by the way, was reportedly a decent-sized gator. Wildlife officials say that the reptile was likely acting defensively. The gator will not face any consequences. As one local quipped, quote, the gator was just being a gator. It's the human who had the questionable judgment here. This incident will likely become part of Florida folklore, a cautionary tale about the dangerous mix of drug abuse, possibly, wildlife, and crime. It's tragic that a life was lost, and undoubtedly Schultz's family is grieving a loved one with a troubled past. Polk County authorities are continuing to investigate the lead-up to the event, including Schultz's mental state and any substances in his system. Body cam footage from the deputies is also being reviewed and could be released later, which may give a fuller picture of how things unfolded minute by minute. But for now, the community is left processing an incident that Sheriff Judd aptly labeled out of the norm by any stretch of the imagination. Okay, on to the next story. Now,
the Disney Plus Hulu Max bundle. It's the ultimate bundle for an unbelievable price. Plans starting at $16.99 a month. Get it and watch Marvel Television's Ironheart on Disney Plus.
I want to build something iconic.
A new season of The Bear on Hulu.
We can make people happy.
And The Epic, a Minecraft movie on Max.
Anything you can imagine is possible.
The Disney Plus Hulu Max bundle. Plans starting at $16.99 a month. All these and more now streaming. Terms apply. Visit DisneyPlusHuluMaxBundle.com for details.
Now, in a true crime saga that has the internet torn, a former U.S. Coast Guard member confessed this week to executing a man she claimed had raped her. And the story only gets more twist-filled from there. Chelsea Perkins, who's 30 years old, pleaded guilty on Monday, May 27th to second-degree murder for the 2021 death of 31-year-old Matthew Dunmire. The case involves an alleged sexual assault, a revenge plot carried out in a national park, and even a botched vigilante attempt by the victim's own parents. So Chelsea's backstory is that after a stint in the Coast Guard, she had transitioned to civilian life and reportedly became an OnlyFans model, going by the name Sabrina Savage online. She lived in Virginia with her husband, and according to investigators, Chelsea accused Matthew Dunmire of raping her in 2020 while she was in Virginia Beach. Matthew was an acquaintance, some reports say coworker or a friend of a friend. However, police in Virginia Beach did not find enough evidence to charge Matthew with sexual assault at that time. So this left Chelsea furious and apparently looking for her own form of justice. So fast forward to March of 2021, Matthew was living in Ohio and Chelsea allegedly devised a plan to lure him into a trap. Posing as a willing date, she connected with Matthew and suggested meeting up when she would be passing through Cleveland. On March 4th of 2021, he drove from Virginia to Ohio using her husband's car, a white sedan, and even renting an Airbnb for a night. She met Matthew at a bar in Cleveland. Witnesses saw him leaving the bar and getting into a white car with a woman that night. They spent one night together at the Airbnb. The next morning, Chelsea told her tattoo artist in Michigan via message that she would be coming in later but had to, quote, make a stop first. Well, that stop turned out to be Cuyahoga Valley National Park, a wooded area outside of Cleveland. Chelsea convinced Matthew to go for a scenic walk in the park on March 5th of 2021, and as they hiked into the secluded area, Chelsea carried out her plan. She shot Matthew in the back of the head, execution style. Hikers in the park discovered his body on March 9th, 4 days later, with a single gunshot wound to the head. Chillingly, next to his body was an Aquafina water bottle that seemed kind of out of place in the woods, but that water bottle would later tie back to Chelsea. Unaware of the discovery, she coolly drove straight to her tattoo appointment in Michigan after the murder as if nothing happened. She got a new tattoo that same day, a detail that has many observers shaking their heads at her composure and has earned her case its macabre nickname, the Tattoo Parlor Killer. It took investigators a couple of weeks to connect the dots. License plate readers and security cameras identified the white car seen with Matthew as belonging to Chelsea's husband. By late March of 2021, authorities tracked her down in Virginia, and they found that very car parked outside her home. And forensic testing later found Chelsea's DNA on that water bottle and on Matthew's body. In August of 2021, she was arrested and charged with Matthew's murder. However, in a twist, months went by without Chelsea being indicted, possibly as the case went through just jurisdictional questions. Since it was a national park, it became a federal case. But this delay infuriated Matthew's grieving parents, who feared that justice was not coming. They just got impatient. So in November of 2021, his parents took matters into their own hands in a vigilante revenge attempt. His mother, Tommy Lynn Dunmire, and father, John McQuillan, drove from Ohio to Washington, D.C., where they believed Chelsea was staying. Tommy even dressed up as a UPS delivery driver and knocked on the door of an address linked to Chelsea Perkins. When a woman answered, Tommy shot her twice in the abdomen without saying a word. But tragically and almost absurdly, the Dunmires got the wrong woman. The person Tommy shot was not Chelsea Perkins at all, but an innocent bystander who had no connection to the case whatsoever. Now, thankfully, that woman survived her gunshot injuries after she had emergency surgery, and the FBI quickly tracked down Matthew's parents' vehicle. As agents closed in, Tommy Lynn Dunmire fatally shot herself, a final anguished act of a mother who had lost her son and was about to be arrested. John McQuillan, the father, surrendered and later pleaded guilty to an accessory charge. He was sentenced to 3 years in prison for his role in the attempted retaliation. Now back to Chelsea Perkins. Despite the chaos, the case against her moved forward. By 2023, she was indicted for murder in federal court since the killing happened on federal land, which was that national park. And this week, rather than go to trial, Chelsea accepted a plea deal. She pleaded guilty to second-degree murder on May 27th, of this year, and as part of the plea, prosecutors and defense agreed on a sentence range of 20 to 25 years in prison. So she'll formally be sentenced in September. At 30 years old now, that means Chelsea Perkins will likely be in her 50s by the time she gets out, if not older. The plea deal also means that Chelsea publicly admitted to luring and killing Matthew, essentially acknowledging that she took the law into her own hands. So I want to hear your thoughts on this. Was this cold-blooded premeditated murder or a rape victim's desperate form of vigilante justice? Many are divided on this. Some commenters hailed Chelsea as a sort of avenging angel, saying things like, "She killed a rapist and then went and got a tattoo. I love her." And they argue that if the system wouldn't punish Matthew Dunmeyer, then Chelsea Perkins was justified in doing so herself. But others see a darker picture. The evidence that a rape even occurred is disputed because, remember, authorities did not charge Matthew Dunmeyer due to lack of evidence. And that's not to say it didn't happen, but to them, Chelsea Perkins might have made up or exaggerated the rape allegation to justify what she wanted to do. Or even if the assault did happen, vigilante murder is still murder. Matthew Dunmeyer had no due process. There's also the matter of Chelsea's behavior after the fact. Driving to get a tattoo immediately after murdering someone suggests a pretty disturbing level of calm. Prosecutors certainly didn't view her as a sympathetic figure. They pursued a murder conviction and were prepared to show a jury how she planned the killing for months. The plea to second-degree murder likely reflects some acknowledgement of her claim of trauma. Perhaps a jury might have felt some empathy if they believed her rape story, but still holds her accountable for a deliberate killing. One additional tragic layer, Matthew Dunmeyer's family, having already lost their son and then their wife and mother, Tommy, to suicide, now had to accept this plea deal. In court, they did not oppose the 20 to 25-year sentence recommendation. According to reports, Dunmeyer's obituary described him as a free spirit who loved music and loved being with his friends. Friends said that he was kind and gentle, casting doubt in their minds that he could have been a rapist. We'll never know the full truth of what transpired between Matthew and Chelsea in Virginia. That remains one of the haunting question marks in this story. But as for Chelsea, she's reportedly expressed some remorse through her attorney, at least for dragging everyone through this mess and for the collateral damage that was caused, like the innocent woman who got shot by Matthew's mom. But notably, she has never publicly recanted her claim that Matthew raped her. So whether that claim was true, false, or something in between, it set in motion a deadly chain of events. And now with her guilty plea, that chain of events has finally reached a courtroom conclusion. The so-called tattoo parlor revenge killer will trade her freedom for decades behind bars. Next, out of Bentonville, Arkansas, a case of extreme child abuse has left even seasoned officers shaken. An Arkansas couple was arrested after a young girl told her school counselor about 3 years of nightmarish abuse, including being starved to just one Pop-Tart a week and subjected to sexual assault and torture. The allegations are so horrific that local media and soon national outlets have dubbed this the Pop-Tart case, referencing the meager scraps of food that the child was given. It's a story that is both heartbreaking and infuriating as the public grapples with how such abuse could go on for so long. The suspects are Annie Kaler, who's 28 years old, and her husband, Daniel Kaler, who's 34. They were arrested by Bentonville police on May 9th, and the victim is a minor child, and her age was not disclosed for privacy. It appears was living with the Kalers for several years. Now, authorities have not confirmed the exact relationship, whether she was a relative, a foster child, or otherwise, but it's clear that the Kalers had guardianship or at least day-to-day care of her during the period in question. The abuse came to light in April when the girl bravely reported the abuse to a school counselor, who then immediately contacted police. Once investigators interviewed the child, a picture emerged of prolonged abuse from August 2020 through March of 2023. According to an affidavit and media reports, Daniel Kaler repeatedly raped the girl over those 3 years, assaulting her sexually hundreds of times. Sickeningly, the child said that Annie Kaler was aware of at least some of this sexual abuse and even witnessed it twice, but did nothing to stop it. Instead, Annie allegedly warned the girl not to say anything or Daniel would kill them both. And that was just the beginning. The physical and psychological abuse that this child endured is staggering. According to police and the victim's account, some of the torture included starvation. The girl said that she was only allowed one Pop-Tart and one glass of water per week as her food and drink. Yes, per week. The rest of the time, she was essentially not fed unless she was being fed scraps at school. But it's hard to fathom how she survived on that. And it just speaks to the level of malnutrition that she likely suffered. She was also forced to ingest hard drugs, including fentanyl, cocaine, and methamphetamine on multiple occasions. The Kaylers allegedly made her participate in their drug deals as well, using her in the process of acquiring or selling drugs. Annie Kaler also once stabbed the girl in the neck with a fork because she was unhappy with how the girl was washing dishes. The girl also described other beatings and instances where she was terrorized with threats on her life. They forced her to sleep in a bathtub without any pillow or blanket. She had no comfortable place to rest, essentially treated worse than an animal. And in one particularly cruel act of neglect, when the girl broke her leg, the Kaylers refused to take her to a doctor or hospital, leaving the injury untreated. It appears they isolated her from others, not allowing her to seek help, and they kept her existence largely in the shadows. The abuse might never have come out if not for that school counselor visit, which suggests that she may not have been taken to school regularly either. Details on that are unclear, but by spring of 2025, she was at least in contact with a counselor who could help. The Kaylers were each charged with a slew of felonies. Daniel Kaler faced charges of rape, sexual assault, permitting the abuse of a minor, and endangering the welfare of a minor. Annie Kaler is charged with introduction of a controlled substance to a minor's body, endangering the welfare of a child, battery, terroristic threatening, and permitting abuse. Both suspects are locked up in the Benton County Detention Center on high bonds, with $750,000 for Daniel and $500,000 for Annie. They've been assigned public defenders and initial court dates were set for June. Now, given the severity of allegations, it's likely that they'll remain behind bars awaiting trial unless those bonds are somehow met, which seems unlikely. The girl is now safe and in protective custody, getting medical care and counseling, and one can only imagine the long road of recovery that's ahead for her. Physically, she had untreated injuries and malnutrition. Psychologically, the trauma of years of abuse will take extensive therapy and support to heal, but there's relief that she is finally free from her tormentors. The courage it took for her to speak up to a school counselor cannot be overstated. That action likely saved her life. But I do have some questions about just how the abuse went unnoticed for so long. Did no other adults in her life see red flags? Was she not enrolled in school consistently? Were there no prior reports or doctor's visits? These were the kind of questions that child welfare officials will probably be examining. Arkansas state authorities have been notified, and an internal review is likely underway to see if any systemic failures occurred. But for now, the focus is on the criminal case against the Kaylers. If convicted on all counts, they could face decades in prison, potentially over a life sentence, given the multiple serious charges. In Arkansas, rape alone can carry a life term. The community's appetite for justice is pretty strong. As one local police officer said, quote, "In 26 years on the job, I've seen some bad things, but this ranks near the top. It's pure evil. We're going to do everything we can to make sure people never hurt a child again." That is it for this week's episode of The Weekly Docket. Thank you so much for tuning in. If you ever have a case recommendation, you can reach out to me on mama.mysterypodcast on Instagram, TikTok, or you can go to mamamystery.com, scroll down to that white box, and you can send me a message. I see all the messages that come through, so I appreciate your support so much. If you liked this episode, please review it, leave a comment, share it, do all the things. Thank you so much for listening. Have a great weekend. Stay vigilant, stay curious. Mama Mystery out. Bye.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. You chose to hit play on this podcast today. Smart choice. Make another smart choice with AutoQuote Explorer to compare rates from multiple car insurance companies all at once. Try it at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance and Affiliates. Not available in all states and situations. Prices may vary on how you buy.